Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome everyone to Senate Judiciary Committee. I'll go ahead and call us to order. Today, we have a number of bills that are up for public hearing and possible work sessions. What we're going to do is, because I have members coming in, so what we're going to do is we're going to start with Senate Bill 144. I know Senator Farioli is here on that bill, and we have a couple other members up for another one. So let's go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 144. And Michael, I think that's yours.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 144 removes the current exemption allowing individuals to keep archaeological objects they unintentionally discover on public lands. It requires the district attorney to determine whether an Indian tribe claims any seized archaeological objects, and requires the Commission on Indian Services to designate appropriate tribes and give them notice of the seizure. There is a dash 2 amendment before you. It requires the district attorney to give written notice to the attorney general if the district attorney declines to prosecute for violations, and gives the attorney general the authority to prosecute. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the amendment.
Gentlemen, good morning, senators.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing the bill. I expect this bill not to be without some controversy. Now, let me tell you the story behind the bill in as brief a method as I possibly can. About 4 years ago, as a member of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, it came to our attention that falling lake levels, because of drought conditions in Oregon at the time, were exposing burial sites, including funerary objects, and that people in recognition of this physical exposure of these funerary objects and artifacts were in fact grid searching on four-wheelers and three-wheelers and picking up the artifacts, sometimes disturbing what were clearly burial sites, and making those available for sale on the internet. Some of those objects are clearly culturally relevant to the people who live and have lived in those locations for 10,000 years. The law that we have is a little ambiguous. It allows people to collect and keep an arrowhead if they find one. The photograph that I distributed through the committee assistant and committee staff is an arrowhead, according to the law, according to some interpretations of the law. This is clearly a ceremonial object. It was found likely associated with a burial site. I have the police report that was attached to that, which for reasons of privacy and non-disclosure, I won't make part of the public record. The case was never prosecuted, even though the state police clearly spent a lot of resources and time and documented this theft of cultural artifact. But because the law was ambiguous as to what may and may not be kept, the district attorney felt either they didn't have the resources to pursue it or they couldn't make the case in court. Case was dismissed, and instead of having the artifact returned to the Native American people from the area, it was given back to the person who discovered it. So Senate Bill 144 is a product of many hundreds of hours of people thoughtfully reviewing the current statute and thinking about how we could solve the problem. What 144 does is that it offers an opportunity for the state attorney general and the AG staff to prosecute where resources are lacking or there is a desire not to prosecute at the local level. It also removes the current exemption for archaeological objects that are discovered unintentionally on public lands. You might not set out to look for culturally relevant articles, but if you discover one under Senate Bill 144, you'd be asked to report it, and it would be eventually returned. Tribes would be notified through the information that would be provided to the LCIS, the Legislative Council on Indian Services. They would forward the information to the appropriate authorities, and then the site would be visited and the artifact protected or collected by the tribe in whose native homeland it exists. You also have before you the Dash 2 amendment, which would allow the Department of Justice to criminally prosecute in cases where the county district attorney is unable to do so or chooses not to do so. The handful of cases that we've seen statewide can be quite complex, not only from the evidentiary standpoint, but just setting precedent in prosecuting these cases where none have been prosecuted in the past. The objective here, of course, is not to create a new cause of action or a new crime. The objective is to make sure that these culturally relevant artifacts, who are part of our collective cultural heritage, are protected and preserved and returned in every case possible to the people whose ancestors created them. And that is the sum total of what Senate Bill 144 does.
Thank you.
I'll defer to my colleague.
Attorney Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5. We are both members of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, and if you look at the top of the page, the other two members, who were the other two members at the time, are the House members, are also on this bill, because the conversations over the last couple of years, in particular about this one artifact, have solidified the feeling of all of us in the legislature who were on that commission that something needed to be done and that we needed to come about it thoughtfully and get to the point where those artifacts can be and will be protected over time. And in my district, we have had a number of cases of burial sites being robbed. There's a lot of cultural stuff up and down the coast, actually. It gets discovered from time to time. And there are people who try to make a lot of money on those artifacts. And in fact, they really belong to the tribes that exist there. And we need to make sure that there is the expertise, knowledge, and ability to take those cases to court. And what this bill does with the Dash 2 amendments is say Oregon takes this very seriously, and when a local prosecutor makes a decision, they need to share that decision with our state people and make sure that we look at that and decide if they're going to take it over and that they have the ability to take over the prosecution, because we believe it's really that important. And I encourage you to look at this, recognize that it's about protecting the cultural heritage of all of Oregon and all of us, and would encourage your support of this with the Dash 2 amendments.
All right, questions? All right. I'm going to just go ahead and put on the record. We have three other panels that are going to come up. The last panel is going to be Tim Callahan and Aaron Knott. I will be asking them regarding the Dash 2s as to whether there's not already dual jurisdiction for the Attorney General to come in. The one thing I didn't see in here, if we're going to put a burden on the district attorney to make a decision as to declining or not wanting to go forward, there's really, it says given timely written notice. When is that going to happen? I mean, in the sense of statute of limitations, there's multiple things that I think we just want to make sure if we're really going to go after it, that we have it tightened down, that there's enough room for the AG's office to actually be able to come in and do what they need to do before they can actually make that decision. So that's where we're at.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the what I'm hearing is that it sounds like you're willing to work the bill, get into the weeds on the details. That's a really critical piece of this. But Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first of all, these artifacts should not be disturbed. And there's a whole range of issues that occur when they are disturbed. You lose the archaeological significance by disturbing the artifact. But there's another dimension here. I don't think that we can overstate the offense or the outrage of having burial sites disturbed. I've had it said by tribal members, they wonder how we would feel if a group of folks showed up at a Pioneer Cemetery with picks and shovels and decided to go souvenir hunting. We probably would be pretty upset by that. We don't seem to be able to translate that into the same sort of outrage that we all ought to feel when Native American burial sites are desecrated. So I hope you'll be able to take action. And, Mr. Chair, we trust this committee to do what it needs to do to make sure the logistics work. But in those cases where we've had good work by the Oregon State Police, good work by local investigators, cases made and delivered to the district attorney ending in no prosecutions, that is a problem, and we need to rectify that.
All right, thank
you. And I just want to say, and you have to understand that when places are found with respect to certain people, maybe I can't take all the things I want to take out, but then it gets around under in the internet and other places where these sites are, and then there is a stream of people who feel like it's their opportunity and their time to go there. And if we don't take action fairly swiftly, the chances of those places, even if the first person did the right thing and left it all alone and sent the message to somebody, people will try to figure out where that is if they've heard about it, and other people are not going to treat it the same way that the first person did. So I think people need to understand how important this is to the tribes in particular, and a lot of us who care very much about keeping that cultural heritage in
okay.
where we are.
Thank you.
But we do appreciate getting it right.
I got three panels.
Okay.
Scott, we're out of here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I got four more bills after that. All right, Aaron Ashley and Louis Pitt, why don't y'all two come forward? Then the next one's going to be Michael Mason and Don Ivey will be the panel after that.
You got something to read?
I do.
Go ahead.
Gentlemen.
Good morning. My name is Aaron Ashley. I'm from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. Thank you for having me this morning. I truly appreciate it. So, like I said, my name is Aaron Ashley. I'm an elected official for the Board of Trustees of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I'm pleased to be here to convey the Confederated Tribes' support of Senate Bill 144 with the -2 amendment drafted by Senator Farioli. Cultural protection, preservation, and perpetuation for the benefit of current and future generations are high priorities of the Confederated Tribes. Preserving culturally significant places and resources, including cultural objects, is paramount. Senate Bill 144 will ensure the return of more cultural resources to tribes. The underlying bill requires that law enforcement provide notice of seizure of contraband items to the Commission on Indian Services and requires the Commission to provide notice to the appropriate tribe. These are important and essential steps to return irreplaceable cultural objects to tribes. The amendment drafted by Senator Farioli at our request also recognizes that tribes have a long history predating the state of Oregon and that the return of cultural objects has not been a priority of the state or local governments. The state of Oregon needs to continue to work with Oregon tribes to improve outreach and education efforts to its citizens of the history of the nine tribes and the respective Aboriginal territories and treaty-protected traditional use places. These irreplaceable cultural objects remain important to the tribe's cultural identity, past, present, and future. The -2 amendment allows the Department of Justice to prosecute cases when local law enforcement is unable to do so. Given this authority to the state is necessary because these prosecutions are often complex and smaller communities lack the resources and adequately address the issues presented. No county, as far as I know, has an archaeologist on staff to address cases such as this. Furthermore, the Department of Justice also has greater expertise with an assistant attorney general who has practiced in this area of law and has authority in civil cases. On behalf of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, I urge your support in voting Senate Bill 144 with the -2 amendment to the floor. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Aaron, thank you. Louis,
appreciate it.
Okay. Louis Pitt, Jr., Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Right off the bat, support of -2 amendments. We've got work on this since 1993. I remember it's down on the other U on here, the other hall, catching the dickens from some of the committee that we needed to do more. Stewardship, that's what this is that stewardship, and another word, your new word for the day, usufructory. And that's part of the rights that tribes have off reservation. Warm Springs, Umatilla is very similar to that. We have off reservation rights, but we have this footprint that's been Indian people all throughout Oregon. So it's, again, stewardship and a responsibility. And as citizens, we're responsible for doing some things. Yes, we have rights. But Aaron's here, and I'm here, and the chief is back there from one of the coastal tribes, is that we have responsibilities, too, as the Indian people. And then this is one of those that you accept as stewardship. So I always, you know, kind of wonder. At one time, the state says, no, we own that. No, we changed the law back in 1993. Stewardship is what it is. And so we're here to help you. And I'll work with Michael Mason and with the technical folks and with Senator Ferrioli and your staff to figure out what really works for us as tribal people and as citizens, too, of Oregon. So, again, support for Dash 2 amendments, narrow definitions. Embarrassing that what has happened down in Lake County, as Senator Ferrioli talked about. So let's encourage them and then... I guess if we have to, you have a process that comes up with a bigger stick to help them keep Oregon, Oregon.
Lori, thank you. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel is Michael Mason and Don Ivey, followed by Tim Callahan and Aaron Knott.
Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs and the Coquille Indian Tribe. We have Chief Don Ivey from the tribe here today. So I'm mostly here to answer questions. This is an issue, as Mr. Pitt mentioned, that we started working on in 1992, but a very important bill passed in 1993. Effort was led then by Senator Ken Baker, and yeoman's service was done by Karen Quigley, who I think enjoyed working on the Indian law issue so much that she became director of the Commission on Indian Services and has maintained that post all these years and done a fabulous job on this effort to preserve the patrimony of all Oregonians. I just want to say this is really a cleanup bill. The Dash 2 is a little more because it responds to a problem that we didn't really foresee. Some of the ignoring of the issues of some of the crimes that are of such critical importance to Indian people today. So I'm just here basically to answer questions. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you. Don?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and offer a few words. My name is Donald Ivey. I live in Coos Bay, Oregon, and I'm an elected official of the Coquille Indian Tribe. I serve on tribal council in the position of chief. What we're really talking about here is Oregon's heritage. We're talking about a shared heritage and a shared history that while Indian people date back 10,000 years or more on this landscape, all the people who live in Oregon today have an interest in taking care of Oregon's heritage. Tribes in particular have a responsibility to that for many, many reasons. The cultural traditions that we've inherited from our ancestors, we're responsible to take care of and to take care of those things for future generations. One of the issues that we have that this Dash 2 amendment addresses is the question of rural Oregon and the resources that rural Oregon can bring to bear anytime Oregon's laws and its statutes are violated. Artifacts, looting, not only of Native American archaeological sites, but many of our historic sites, is the contraband and the currency of criminal activity in the state of Oregon. It's well documented. It goes on all the time. nefarious characters packing arrowheads and other things in their pockets for trade and currency. We're talking about stewardship. We're talking about taking care of Oregon's heritage and Oregon's history as it has come to us and as we would have it in the future. Lake County has been mentioned, but virtually every county in the state of Oregon has suffered the instance when the district attorney, because of time, energy, resources, the politics of the community, whatever it may be, has declined or has been unwilling or unable to prosecute. Asking for the attorney general to step in these matters is not just a matter of bailing out any particular county or responding to the particulars of any individual Indian tribe. It is about taking care of Oregon's history and its heritage and our responsibilities to be stewards of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for our panel? All right, thank you very much. Our last panel on this bill is going to be Tim Callahan and Aaron Knott. While they're coming up, was there anyone else who didn't get signed up for SB 144 who wanted to give testimony?
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. I understand you're here in neutral, but if you could maybe go over the areas that I had raised, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Przonski. Members of the committee, I'm Tim Callahan, Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As far as the bill itself, as drafted, absolutely no problem. Our concerns do center around the Dash 2 amendments. We think it would be very beneficial if the Attorney General's office, the District Attorney Association, perhaps the sponsors of the bill get together and have a discussion about some of the potential conflicts that may occur as a result of the amendments as they are presently drafted. And I think I'm confident that we can work that out.
Okay, great. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General and Department of Justice, here mostly just to contextualize the questions that the chair raised earlier. So, with a typical criminal charge, the Attorney General does not have originating jurisdiction, meaning we can't go into a county and prosecute a theft. We can't go into a county and prosecute a stolen car case. There are a few statutorily enumerated examples where we do have jurisdiction in one form or another. Organized criminal activity is one, for example, where we have a little bit more jurisdiction to actually initiate investigations. In terms of this particular charge, right now, as far as I know, it's like any other charge, meaning typically when we become involved, it's on invitation of a district attorney. The Department of Justice does have dedicated staff with training and experience in this area. We do have jurisdiction to prosecute the theft of tribal artifacts. Well, prosecute would be the wrong word, but civilly, where we can impose civil damages. And we do have an assistant attorney general who has prosecutorial experience in these cases. So I suppose my testimony would be that we have the capacity to do the work if that was the legislature decision. We're happy to engage in any discussions about specific language.
Okay, questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you. What I'd like for y'all to do is go ahead and have that little work group. Michael's here to help organize that, but as you know, the time is getting closer. My plan at this point is go ahead and post it this by Friday, saying that it's continuing. Hopefully that y'all will be able to come up with some decisions near that time. We'll have another week and a half afterwards, but as you can imagine, we're going to have a crunch. So thank you very much for your assistance and your willingness to sit down with the advocates to work through the Dash 2s. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 144. We're opening up our second hearing for today. We're going to go ahead and open up Senate Bill 1006. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1006 requires judges and law enforcement officials to complete a certification form designated by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services in the Department of Homeland Security that indicates a victim of crime is being or is likely to be helpful in a criminal prosecution. The bill requires that the form be completed within 90 days or, if the removal proceedings are pending within 14 days. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Senator Taylor, I know you are here on this, and then I also have Amanda from your office. Are both of you going to be coming up? Yeah, Allie. I just want to make sure I get everyone up that I need. So the two of you will be testifying. Then we have Kevin Neely that also is here in a neutral slot.
Okay. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. I'm here today to request your consideration for Senate Bill 1006. This bill comes to you at the request of former Representative Joe Gallegos, as well as hardworking advocates and attorneys who regularly work to find ways to assist and support vulnerable individuals living in our state. I'm not a legal expert on this issue, but I'm thrilled to be the drafting sponsor of the bill and support the great work and hopefully take meaningful steps to support crime victims. It is well known that perpetrators of certain crimes, especially perpetrators of intimate partner violence and sexual assault, target vulnerable individuals. Undocumented crime victims are especially vulnerable to these types of crimes due to fears of being blamed, not being believed, or being punished or even deported by coming forward. And as such, perpetrators know that these victims are unlikely to report the crime to seek assistance. The U non-immigrant visa, commonly referred to as a U visa, was created in order to support law enforcement's ability to investigate and prosecute crimes and support undocumented crime victims to report crimes, which, in my opinion, helps to demonstrate that no victim is to blame for a perpetrator's actions and no one deserves to be a victim of these types of crimes. The U visa is a federal program and which was passed by Congress in the year 2000. This non-immigrant visa is for victims of crimes who have suffered substantial mental or physical abuse and are willing to assist law enforcement and government officials in the investigation or prosecution of the criminal activity. Locally, a representative from a certifying agency, such as a judge, prosecuting attorney, or law enforcement, must complete a quote-unquote certification of helpfulness to demonstrate that the victim has been helpful, is being helpful, or is likely to be helpful. Senate Bill 1006 seeks to help crime victims by adding consistency and predictability to the process with which crime victims seek the certification of helpfulness and is modeled after a similar concept from California, Senate Bill 674. Ali Schneider is an expert on this process and is here to speak in greater detail about the bill. I know proponents are seeking some changes to add clarity, and additionally, we have been in conversation with law enforcement and the ODAA, and their complete feedback is pending, and the conversation is very much open. Again, I am far from an expert on this issue, but I believe that regardless of where you're from or what your documentation status, you deserve, if you are a victim of a crime like sexual assault or domestic violence, you deserve the ability to come forward with that crime and seek services to get the necessary medical support and safety resources. I want to thank the good former representative and now the Oregon Commissioner on Hispanic Affairs, Joe Gallegos, for bringing this forward and the advocates who are working diligently on this. I am hopeful we can move forward and better address the needs of these vulnerable crime victims. Thank you, Chair Pozanski, and I'm going to turn it over here to Ms. Schneider.
Good morning. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Ali Schneider, and I am a co-founder of Meadowlark Immigration, but I also worked in nonprofit for 5 years at Catholic Charities, working mostly with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, but the U visa is for all victims of crimes, of serious crimes. The purpose of this bill is to clarify and give guidance to police officers, district attorneys, and other certifiers in the process, because currently across the state of Oregon, the process is inefficient and misunderstood often. And that is putting a strain on police departments, on the DA's offices, but it also puts a strain and results in a punishment of the victims of these crimes. So there are many issues at hand. One is that these certifications, sometimes the crime will have happened a long time ago, and the victim did not know about when, about the U visa or that this option was available. But the most important thing is that, especially in this current climate, there is a lot of fear of police, fear of people are afraid to leave the house. And that is even more of an issue with victims of crimes who, through the especially especially survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, who through the course of power and control of an abuser, they are even more unlikely to be able to leave the house. So fostering the relationships between the investigating agencies and these survivors is very important to, and it goes to the direct purpose of why the U visa was created in the first place. Currently, as the bill is drafted, it requires several amendments to be able to actually be efficient and be helpful to certifiers. Because the California bill, which has been very successful, has included many details and items to help guide these certifying agencies. Currently, for example, with the Portland Police Bureau, they have a very streamlined, efficient process, and it is made it easier for both us as attorneys, but also for their office in that relationship. But there are police departments that maybe don't see what the U visa is, and they aren't informed and they aren't educated. And if there was a bill that explained in detail what the process is, they would better be able to do their job, and it wouldn't be such a burden on those agencies as well. But ultimately, the purpose is to protect victims or survivors of these crimes and to have better community relations between these agencies. I think there's a lot more that I could go into about the details, but today the importance of the bill is just that there be some kind of uniform process, and that will assist everybody. And thank you very much.
Allie, thank you very much. So what I'm reading or hearing between the lines, I guess, is that you think additional work needs to be done, an amendment needs to be put together. As I just told the last group on the last bill, times of the essence. And so if you haven't started working on that, you should be doing that as soon as possible.
We already have the suggestions. They just need to be offered. Or I don't know how the process works. I'm an attorney.
So we're gonna help, as you can, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, it's obviously a complicated issue, and all the T's had to be crossed and all the I's dotted, and we are going to help make the amendment happen. We, even though it wasn't prepared, we wanted to come forward and present in front of you today.
No, so. And that's fine. I mean, we're going to work the same type of process as we said with the last bill. So as far as I'm concerned, as a chair, I'm willing to move it forward, but we want to make sure we got everything together. And what I'm going to ask you to do is include in that conversation Kevin Neely, who's coming up in the neutral, but it seems to me that you're going to potentially have some impact on the district attorneys. And so I think it's important for you to get that feedback before you put stuff into LC, because what's not going to work is to have them to come back and say, this doesn't work, we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, just in response to that, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee.
Don't worry about that.
Thank you.
It's too early in the morning for that.
Yes.
He's very nice. He's very nice.
I appreciate your patience. Just in response to that, I think that the wonderful thing about working in Oregon is that we have already created a lot of these relationships so that we can continue these conversations, but I think making it official will make it easier for other departments that have not yet dealt with it. And I think the last thing I want to say is that we don't want to penalize people based on where the crime was committed, that if it was committed in one part of the state versus another, that one person will be more likely to receive a certification than another person.
I agree with that. All right. Thank you all very much.
Is there
any questions for this panel?
Chair, I don't have a question, but I just a brief comment that I am a co-chief sponsor of this bill, and I want to make sure that's on the on the record.
It's on the record. It's right there.
Okay. For those that didn't know.
All righty.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, and thank you, Senator Manning. I appreciate the we appreciate the support. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Kevin, if you'll come up, please. And while he's coming up, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on SB 1006? Kevin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. First, right off the bat, Senator Taylor's office has been very outstanding in bringing us into the process, asking us questions. And the prior testimony, as they indicated, there are some offices that really have an expertise in this area. They use the U visa process regularly. Marion County did five of them just yesterday. We do have a couple concerns with the timelines on this bill. We're more than happy to work with the sponsor of the bill to try and iron those out. I know the chiefs and sheriffs who can't be here today have submitted written testimony. They have similar concerns to ours. We're more than happy to do as you've just instructed, sit down with them and see if we can iron out our differences very quickly.
That'd be great. Yeah, I think if you could bring in Kevin Campbell on behalf of the sheriffs and the chiefs, that would be great too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He's already indicated he's happy to do it.
Yeah. Any questions? Thank you very much, Kevin. I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on Senate Bill 1006, and that's going to bring us to our third bill for the day, which is Senate Bill 935. And Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 935 increases the maximum length of the transitional leave program for eligible offenders from 90 days to 180 days. Thank you.
All right. I have a number of people who'd like to give testimony today. What I'm going to do is call up the proponents first. Who I have on this list at this point is Steve Berger. Right? Oh, all right. I'm sorry. I didn't follow the script. Kelly? I think we're going to have Kelly come up first, and you're going to give us a year two short-term transitional leave report, I guess, to frame us as we take our testimony after that. And Steve, I'm sorry for the quickness on my part, and it looks like I went a little too quick.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Officer, and I'm a research analyst at the Criminal Justice Commission. I prepared a presentation on the short-term transitional leave program in Oregon and the research the CJC has done on this program. So I'll just take you through the summary of that work. Our report is now out. We just released it last month. It's on our website and available. And the presentation today will just go over the findings of that work. A quick background. Oregon's Justice Reinvestment Act, House Bill 3194, passed in July 2013, and that bill expanded the STTL program from 30 days to 90 days. It also increased the number of participants in the program. Our study looks at performance measures or utilization measures of the program. We've also looked at two-year recidivism rates or rates of reoffending for those who released to STTL from December 2013 to October 2014. And then also one-year recidivism rates for a more recent group from November 2014 to October 2015. So here are just a couple quick performance measures of the program. This shows those released to short-term trans leave for just over a three-year period, January 2014 to February 2017. So you can see that 83% of those who participated in the program were male and 17% were female. For reference, the prison population is roughly about 9% female. So the short-term trans leave program does have a higher percentage of female participants in the program. Here is also how that looks by crime type. So again, those who released to short-term transitional leave for just over a three-year period is roughly about a third per crime type. So about a third person, property, and statutory crimes. This graph shows the prison bed savings and the jail bed days used. Also for almost a three-year period of those who release to short-term transitional leave. So if one individual participates in short-term trans leave for 90 days, then that one person has 90 prison bed days saved. So we've added up all the prison bed days saved since January 2014. So you can see on that graph that that is just over 200,000 prison bed days saved. That's compared to just over 5,000 jail bed days used. So if an individual is on short-term trans leave and they have a violation, they can serve a jail sanction in the community for that violation. And so this shows what the jail bed days used have been for those participating in this program. One of the intentions of the sentencing change of short-term transitional leave was to save prison beds for the DOC, and that has happened as intended over the last 3 years. I want to show on our website an interactive data page that we put together. So I'm going to see if I can make it work on here, if I can get to it. Okay, so this is on the CJC website. We have interactive data pages, and we have one specific to short-term transitional leave. We've worked with the Department of Corrections to get all the data that we need to be able to put this together and then to show these measures. Now, this is available on our website, so it's very convenient. Anybody can go on here, select a county or the measures that they want to look at, and it's all available. So this also shows the jail bed days used and prison bed days saved, summing up from January 2014. So again, this shows the prison bed days saved and the jail bed days used. And then we have the completion rate here. So there is about 6% of those who participate in the program who do not successfully complete it, and about 94% who do successfully complete it. And so we can click here to see, oh, it's going to reload here just for a minute. Ooh. There we go. So for those 6% who do not successfully complete the program, about two-thirds do not successfully complete without a new crime. So they did not meet the conditions of the program and did not successfully complete it, but did not complete a new crime. And then about a third did have a new crime during that period that they were on short-term transitional leave. And then we have additional pages here. So this shows the 30-day versus the 90-day impact. The 30-day short-term trans leave is for those who were sentenced before August 1st, 2013, and then the 90 days for those sentenced after August 1st, 2013. So you can see over time, the 30-day has phased out and the 90-day has come online, which has contributed to that additional prison bed days saved from the program. This is a handy page because you can click on the county, Marion County, which we're in right now. So you can see there have been 552 participants on short-term transitional leave in Marion County. And then down here, you can see the 30 versus 90-day utilization for that county. So in February 2017, there were 12 individuals who started their 90-day STTL in Marion County, and then one individual on the 30-day short-term transitional leave. And we have similar pages for those who start the program and those who fail the program. Looking at it this way, so you can see that failure rate over time for the short-term transitional leave program. And then we also have the prison savings and jail usage over time. So you can see this increase here is as the 90-day is coming online, resulting in that additional savings. And then the jail bed days used in the yellow below. So again, we can click on Marion County here and see that impact in Marion County over time. So in September 2016, there were 1,350 prison bed days saved, and in September there were 32 jail bed days used. So we wanted to quickly show that to you to show that this is on our website for anybody to go look at these measures of how short-term transitional leave is looking statewide and then also in a particular county. Go back to the presentation.
All right, before we go to the presentation, yeah. Mm-hmm. I want a clarification since you're on this. So did I understand, of the 6% that failed, one-third of them actually failed because of a new crime, which means the other two-thirds of that 6% failed based on what we would call technical violations?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dimbro.
Just to follow up on that, of the third that did commit an offense, Do you have a sense of what kinds of crimes were committed?
We do have that data available to us. I'll show you in some upcoming slides the recidivism rate analysis that we did, which looks at the types of offenses. That just looks at arrest, conviction, and incarceration. We do have the details of that. It is very similar to the rate of crimes we see coming into the system overall. So it can just be felony drug possession. It can be a more serious person crime. It can be a misdemeanor crime. So we have that data available and could pull that together to show what that looks like. And now these folks that had a new crime, which was why they failed short-term transitional leave, they committed their crime while they were on that short-term transitional leave period. So that's up to the 90 days. And then the study that I am presenting in the next few slides shows the one-year and two-year recidivism rate. So that gives a longer look at the time in the community and those crimes committed in that longer period of time as well.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Okay, so I'll go back to the slides here. Okay, so now I wanted to give the background on the recidivism analysis that we did. So we looked at recidivism rates or rates of reoffending for those who released a short-term trans leave compared to those who were statutorily eligible for short-term trans leave but did not participate in the program. So there are several reasons why that can happen. There's a DOC approval process that happens within the institution to qualify for the program, and that includes things like discipline or behavior issues within the institution, treatment or other program failures, or detainers, which is holds for pending cases or warrants, as an example. So if an individual qualifies on the institution side, then their application is sent to the county that they will release to, and then the county can either approve or disapprove their application to participate in the program. So the county approval process also has several criteria, some of which are whether the housing plan is adequate and appropriate, any victim safety concerns, or prior compliance issues on supervision. So this is kind of an overview of the requirements to participate in the program. So we have, unfortunately, data is not available on all of these qualification criteria. So for those who did not participate, we can't tell exactly why they didn't participate. So because of that limitation, when we do this recidivism rate comparison, we cannot conclude that the difference in these recidivism rates is because of the participation in short-term trans leave, because of the additional supports and services around this program. The differences between the two groups have these unmeasured factors, such as any victim safety concerns, adequate housing, criteria such as that. And so those criteria could also be associated with STTL participation and could also be associated with lower recidivism rates. So one way we could have done this study was to look at those who participated in short-term trans leave after 3194 and then go back to prior to 3194 and look at those individuals and try to figure out who would have qualified for the program and then look at their recidivism rates and compare the two. If we were able to do that, then we would have a much stronger conclusion that those differences were actually because of the short-term trans leave program. We've explored that, and unfortunately the data is not available to us, so we really can't tell. You know, for folks that released from prison in 2011 and 2012 and the first part of 2013, we don't know if their housing was adequate. We don't know if there were victim safety concerns in the community. We don't know if the county would have approved those individuals to participate in the program at that time. And so since we can't identify who would have participated, we haven't been able to do that longitudinal study across these two groups. So we just do have data limitations in order to do that. But because we've compared those who participated in short-term trans leave versus those who did not participate but were eligible based on their crime of conviction, we can conclude that those who participate in the program have a lower recidivism rate than those who did not participate. So I'll show you what that looks like here in this bar graph. So these are individuals. The orange bar is those who released a short-term transitional leave from December 2013 to October 2014, about 1,000 individuals. And then the blue bar is about 2,300 individuals who were statutorily eligible for trans leave but did not participate. And so this is the recidivism rate comparison across those two groups. So the first column is the arrest for any new crime. And you can see across all three measures that the orange bar is a little lower than the blue bar. So we have seen those lower recidivism rates. On the arrest measure, they're not that different. So it's 45.5% compared to 43.7%. So it is lower, but when we look at that, it's not a statistically significant difference. So that difference could have occurred by chance in comparing those two groups. When we look at the conviction rate for a new misdemeanor or felony crime, that difference is a little larger. So it's 36.7% for those who did not participate in STTL and 33% for those who did participate. So that difference was statistically significant, meaning there's a very low probability that that difference occurred by chance across those two groups. Same thing for the incarceration rate. That difference was also statistically significant. So that was 18.9% for those who did not participate in STTL compared to 15.6% who did participate in STTL. So again, I just want to reiterate that we are seeing this lower recidivism rate, but we can't conclude that it's because of the short-term transitional leave program. It could be that those individuals who qualify for the program are already more likely to be successful than those who did not qualify for the program. But we are seeing a lower recidivism rate for those who participate, so we're not seeing that negative public safety impact of those participating in the program. We've tried to make that clear in our report, and I want to make sure that that's clear for the committee today as well. We also did, so as I said, we can't account for those unmeasured factors, but there are some measures that we can account for. So we did account for the demographic and criminal history variables that were available. So for those that released a short-term trans leave, we found their, quote, twin in the group that did not release a short-term trans leave. So we were able to match on gender, race, age, the risk to recidivate score, and the crime type. So when we did that, we matched 983 out of 1,083 STTL releases. So that's a 95% match. That's pretty good on the statistical side. So we have been able to account for these demographic and criminal history factors. Again, this doesn't account for those other factors that we can't measure, such as housing, victim safety concerns, and those compliance issues, to name a few. When we did that, the recidivism rates were fairly similar for the matched groups. So here we have two even groups, 983 in both groups, and like I said, these groups are the same on those factors that we had available. So gender, race, age, risk to recidivate score, and crime type. And so again, that arrest difference was not statistically significant, but the conviction rate was statistically significant. So 37.7% compared to 33.1% was a significant difference. And the incarceration rate was also significantly different at 19.9% compared to 15.7%. So that wraps up the presentation, and I'll be happy to take questions.
All right. Are there questions at this time, Senator Denborough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I'm not quite sure how to ask this, but how confident are you that the trends that you're showing will hold up over time?
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, that's a really great question. So we've had 2 years now to track these recidivism outcomes. The statewide recidivism definition is 3 years. So it does take some time for us to see, you know, what happens at the 3-year mark and even what happens beyond that, right, in terms of the public safety impact. So we did, a year ago, we did the 1-year look at the recidivism rates. We found differences. We've now done the 2-year rate and found those differences. We don't know if those will hold for the 3-year rate. Enough time hasn't passed for us to be able to see that, and so we really can't make that conclusion. We've done prior studies where we see a difference at the 1 year, and then by the 3-year, you know, by the 1 year it's here, and then it comes together over time, right? The impact of the intervention has kind of been diluted over time, and then we've seen by the 3-year rate that it's gone away. Whether that will happen here or not is not clear. We do have the 2-year rates, and it's a pretty significant sample size of nearly 1,000 individuals. But it is possible that it would go away at that 3-year mark. We really don't know for sure. It's also possible that it would hold at that 3-year mark as well. So we can't say if it'll last.
We can ask that question in a year, and we'll have a better answer.
Definitely, yes. I'm sure January 2018, we will be updating this work, most definitely.
But if I could follow up, and that's certainly an important consideration, but I'm also thinking in terms of the value or the danger of the, you know, the extra time that's been given, right, the 30 days to 90 days. And so far it appears that there's not an increased risk to the public by that added time. Mm-hmm. So the question is, do you think that will hold up? I guess that's really
sure.
what I'm asking.
Sure.
Because I think there's concern about, you know, just the fact of adding time is going to increase risk. I think we can all agree that the benefits are very clear in terms of the beds and the savings in cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, that is a great question. You know, when 3194 passed in 2013, one of the major elements of that was expanding short-term trans leave from 30 days to 90 days. So that was the decision to say, hey, we're going to try this program out, see if it works, both in the prison bed savings and also in the public safety impact. So at this point, 2 years out, we're not seeing the negative public safety impact for that. You can see the qualification criteria to participate in the program is fairly in-depth. There's the approval process from the Department of Corrections, that also that approval process from the county that the individual's releasing to. And really, both sides have leeway in terms of letting somebody participate in that program. If there are concerns about this person's success in the program or any victim safety concerns, you know, if they seem to be behaving well when they're being looked at and then they're not behaving well when they're not being looked at, you know, as soon as that comes to light, then that person is not going to be eligible to participate in the program. And there doesn't need to be, you know, a solid piece of paper that has that information. So Jeremiah Stromberg is here from the Department of Corrections. He can talk more about that. But I do think because we're seeing this drop in the recidivism rates, we are picking the folks who are more likely to be successful out of this pool. And we are seeing that 2 years out for this first group.
All right. Thank you, Kelly, for your presentation.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and call up Senator Steiner Hayward, as well as I'm going to go ask Steve Berger. If you'll come on up, I'm going to kind of break up the panels here based on the numbers that we have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate, District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to testify on this important bill today. I will not claim expertise on criminal justice issues or public safety issues. I will claim an increasing interest in this due to my understanding about the intersection between areas that have been of long-term concern for me, social determinants of health and helping Oregon be the healthiest state in the nation, and our criminal justice and public safety system. I've had the opportunity over the past year or so to work much more closely with our local public safety coordinating committees, with the groups that are looking at justice reinvestment in both Washington and Multnomah counties, both of which I serve, and to have conversations with folks from a range of organizations that are concerned about issues such as this. And it is with that intent that I come to you with this bill to allow counties the opportunity to increase the length of short-term trans leave up to 180 days. And I want to point out a couple of qualifiers in that statement. This is optional, at least according to my bill. Counties do not have to participate. It would be a decision reached by the local public safety coordinating commission, which includes a wide range of stakeholders who are concerned about public safety in their communities. Furthermore, they would not have to do it at the same length for every single person. They, as Ms. Officer pointed out, have a great deal of discretion about deciding whether someone is eligible, should be eligible for short-term trans leave, and whether the community can offer the kinds of services that are appropriate to that person reentering the community to make sure that he or she has the lowest probability of recidivating. Further, I want to point out to you that while, as Ms. Officer said, we cannot guarantee that this is improving recidivism rate, we should be pretty clear at this point that it is not worsening recidivism rates. And that's an important distinction, as Senator Denbrough pointed out. I've had some conversations most recently, 2 minutes ago, with Mr. Stromberg and others from the Department of Corrections to confirm my belief that just as we know that with cancer, the longer you go before a recurrence, the less likely you are to recur, the same thing is true of recidivism. The longer you are out from your original crime, the less likely you are to recidivate. So the fact that statistics are looking good at 2 years is certainly reassuring about what we're likely to see at 3 years. I would not claim a guarantee, but I would claim that the statistics and the probability suggest that likelihood. One of the things that this state holds dear is that people have the opportunity to have a second chance. They have an opportunity to learn from their mistakes, to take advantage of programs that help them become more productive citizens of our state, and to pay back their debt to society, but then go on to have a role in maintaining a healthy family, having an honest wage-earning job, and contributing to our community. Short-term trans leave has offered that opportunity to people in a way that we had not seen possible prior to the implementation of House Bill 3194. And, Mr. Chair, I want to personally thank you for the hard work you invested in getting that bill passed 4 years ago, because it's really made a difference for our community. So I believe that allowing counties the opportunity, if they so choose, to increase that time period will bring more people back into the community sooner, will give them more opportunities to get the services that they need to help them gain gainful employment, stable housing, get the treatment that they need to move forward with their lives as productive, law-abiding citizens of the state of Oregon. We know that we have saved a lot of prison beds. However, we have not stabilized our prison populations, in particular in the women's prison, where we are working very, very hard to avoid having to open a new wing to accommodate a burgeoning population of female prisoners. Increasing the opportunities for short-term trans leave would help us in that effort. Bear in mind also that this is prospective, just as 3194 was. This will only apply to people sentenced after after this bill takes effect, so there would not be any concerns about truth in sentencing, which I know is a concern for many people. Finally, some people may refer during the course of testimony in this bill to a side letter that was signed in 2013 saying that this issue would not be taken up again for 5 years and expressed concerns that it's not been the 5 years yet. I would point out that two things about that. I certainly respect the work that went into creating that side agreement. But first of all, we all know that we can't bind for future legislatures. Second of all, we have a different governor. And third, that bill, that agreement was predicated on our prison population stabilizing or even declining a little bit, which has not yet occurred. And what we do not want to have to do is open new prisons. The last thing the state can afford to do is put more and more of our hard-earned tax dollars into prisons instead of education and health care and the human services that will prevent people from interacting with criminal justice system in the first place. So I thank you in advance for your serious consideration of this bill. I look forward to your hearing from the testimony of others with much more expertise than I, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, and you're scheduled, do you probably have other obligations?
Yes, sir. I'm supposed to be my committee. My own committee.
All right. Thank you very much for coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
All right. Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Chair Prezansky, Co-Chair Thatcher, and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Steve Berger. I'm president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. Our association wishes to voice general support for Senate Bill 935, which seeks to expand short-term trans leave, commonly referenced as STTL, beyond the 90-day maximum for certain specified sentences. I'll skip past some of the context, as we've recently heard the presentation by the Criminal Justice Commission, and I'll just kind of reference the context of House Bill 3194 in that during the subsequent years, Department of Corrections has enhanced their reentry efforts in partnership with Community Corrections, and STTL has been the single most successful strategy preventing the expansion of our prison system. I want to emphasize the findings that Kelly Officer with the Criminal Justice Commission just shared a few moments ago. Inmates who participate in the short-term trans leave program show lower 1 year and 2 year recidivism rates than inmates who were statutorily eligible but did not participate. Specifically, the 2 year incarceration rate for short-term trans leave group dropped 17.4% compared to the non-STTL group, and the 2 year conviction rate for the STTL group dropped 10% compared to the non-STTL group. Community Corrections and the Department of Corrections are continuing to work together closer than ever in coordinating release and reentry. I believe we're being good stewards of the program that's been entrusted to our partnership. I highlight that success of STTL to emphasize again the strength of the state-county partnership. At this time, we have demonstrated success with the 90-day STTL, and we support expanding the maximum length. Although our association is not advocating for a specific length of expanded STTL, we support the opportunity for each county in partnership with Department of Corrections to provide transition services beyond the current 90-day maximum. The question moving forward is finding the right balance of transition length and community resources to continue our success. We look forward to working with the legislature and our criminal justice stakeholders in determining the next steps for STTL. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for Steve? Steve, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to include Trues Neal and Amanda Hess.
All right.
Chair Przanski, Co-Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. I am Truls Neal, Deputy Director from Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Multnomah County strongly supports expanding short-term trans leave from 90 to 100 days with, when appropriate. Short-term trans leave is an important component of HB House Bill 3194 that currently allows 90 days early release to supervision. Since implementation of 3194 just in Multnomah County, Multnomah County accounts for more than 45,000 prison bed days that have been saved. When Kelly was up here, I think the whole number was 200,000. So I think we're almost a quarter of those. So we're very proud of that. And we're also proud of the fact that 89% of our participants in Multnomah County have been successful through their 90-day short-term trans leave. Multnomah County has been an active partner and committed to finding ways to reduce prison bed usage. We are proud of the collaboration and partnership that have been developed with our public safety partners as a result of the implementation of 3194. This commitment includes actively looking for additional ways to reduce prison bed usage. Since the passage, we have been a part of several conversations and solutions around ways to reduce prison beds. This includes being one of five counties taking part in the Family Alternative Sentencing Program that we'll be talking about later. When forecasts began showing the possible need to open an additional prison due to growing women's population, along with several other counties, we began to explore ways to work with women who are eligible to be released from prison early. We view the expansion of short-term trans leave up to 180 days as another viable option to continue to reduce the women's prison bed population. If we have the opportunity to expand up to 180 days, Multnomah County is prepared and committed to work with the Department of Corrections to expand release days when transition services are identified and an early release is appropriate. It is possible that in some situations, less than 180 days, but more than a 90-day release to short-term trans leave would be appropriate. This bill would give us this flexibility. In summary, I respectfully request that you support Senate Bill 935. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Amanda?
Yes. Hi, for the record, my name is Amanda Hess, and I'm here on behalf of Partnership for Safety and Justice. For those of you that don't know, PSJ is a nonprofit organization that advances proven strategies that achieve safe and strong communities, prevent crime, and provide opportunities for both victims and people who commit crimes to rebuild their lives. PSJ supports the expansion of short-term transitional leave and thanks Senator Steiner Hayward for forwarding this legislation this session. Short-term trans leave recognizes the fact that the vast majority of folks that enter the criminal justice system will return back to the community. Short-term trans leave has shown, as Kelly Officer has illustrated in her report, that it in fact saves the state money and reduces recidivism, reduces crime. That is the kind of work we should expand and support, especially in this budget climate. The state's $1.7 billion budget deficit means that the Department of Corrections has already had to cut critical programs, including 140 treatment beds, when 70% of our women's population and 50% of our men suffer from addiction and mental health issues. As you know, we also face cuts to local communities through justice reinvestment and community corrections. While we understand there are some concerns about the lack of transitional housing and community services, we know that expanding short-term trans leave will free up desperately needed resources for programs that further reduce recidivism and keep our communities safe. We believe that counties have been doing a successful job with the discretion that they've been given, and that discretion should be entrusted upon them in further expanding the program. We believe that we can keep communities safe while holding people accountable by expanding short-term trans leave. Thank you for your support and your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and ask Doug Martini and Kevin Neely to come up next, and then we'll go back to neutral with Jeremiah.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. I'm Doug Martini, the District Attorney of Linn County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Let me just start by saying, and it was referenced before, I believe this bill violates the 5-year moratorium on changes to our sentencing laws that were negotiated and agreed to in the 2013 session as part of House Bill 3194. That was agreed upon by leaders of the legislature. Folks sought the support of the Oregon District Attorneys Association for House Bill 3194, which reduced prison sentences. It also increased transition leave from 30 days to 90 days. And that was a term specifically I was in on the discussions that we were very concerned about in the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And we're worried about it because it reduces an important concept of our system, which is truth in sentencing. But in exchange for our support, we received a promise of a 5-year moratorium. And so we swallowed some of the bitter pills that we saw within House Bill 3194. A statement was made that this promise is contingent upon stabilization of the prison numbers or the decrease. And I actually have the agreement that was signed right here. That was an incorrect statement. What it actually says is the prison population should remain below 15,200. That has happened. In fact, if my numbers are correct, I believe they are today, the prison numbers are 14,635. One reason why we believe that this 5-year moratorium is important is so that we can have more chance to look at the data. Ms. Officer has been very helpful to my office when I make requests to her for information as well. And she did point out there are just some things we still don't know yet. We only have 2 years of the study. This agreement was signed by a leader whose name, the title next to her name at the time, was the House Majority Leader.
Who else did you have signed on that?
Andy Olson and Representative Chris Garrett, who both were very engaged in important parties as we all were negotiating House Bill 3194.
And Doug, did you see any names from the Senate, including myself or
no, sir.
Senator Winters, who were the other two participants in those discussions?
No, sir, I do not.
Or the President of the Senate?
No. I do have a letter from the executive branch, which is the governor. But governor. What I would say is this. We have a vested interest, both the majority and the minority, have a vested interest in ensuring that when the signatures are attached that it actually means something. The majority has the vested interest to make sure that the majority leader's word is trusted and is given full effect. And the minority party should have a vested interest in making sure that when the majority leader speaks and signs to something that their word means something. And if it doesn't, they should call out the majority who signed that. But that's actually not the most important reason why I oppose this bill. The most important reason is because it erodes an important pillar of a good justice system, and that's truth in sentencing. When a court declares a punishment, it attaches a number of months that a person must serve in prison, and the court is declaring what justice is for the community. When taxpayers pay for a criminal justice system, they're trusting that when someone breaks into their home or assaults the mother of some children or steals a car, which frankly represents hours and or months of someone's labor, when that's stolen from them, they're trusting that there's a system that's going to declare justice. The state suffers from a scheme that hides the ball from the victims and the public. At a sentencing hearing, a judge will declare Oregon's determination of justice. It's declared solemnly, and an order is issued where a specific number of months is attached to how long someone will be serving in prison. And that's the only number that the judge declares regarding incarceration. Naturally, that's what the public, that's what the victims, and that's what the press all look to decide whether or not this justice system is delivering justice.
Doug, can I hang on one
yes,
second?
Sir.
Senator Lithicum, did you have a follow-up on that last stuff?
I was just curious if that was submitted to OLIS.
It's not.
the agreement?
Yes.
I'd be happy to submit it. Sure. So that's the number that everyone looks to see whether or not the system is delivering justice. However, camouflaged in such terms as alternative incarceration program, short-term transition leave, earned time credits, couched in those camouflaging terms are insidious reductions that can cumulatively reduce sentences by half or more. And that's a fraud upon the victims and the public. And this bill further increases that fraud and erodes truth in sentencing. If you need to decrease sentences to save money, then I invite you to have the political courage and integrity to reduce them in the light of day and call them sentence reductions. Please don't declare justice and then surreptitiously deny victims of the justice that is declared in the courtroom. Crime victims already suffer at the hands of dishonest criminals. They shouldn't also suffer from a dishonest sentencing scheme. And so I ask you and invite you to please help build a system that has integrity and protects truth in sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Senator Dimbrough first.
Thank you. I appreciate that perspective, but I really disagree with it. And I think I would be more comfortable with that line of thinking if we were retroactively applying this, if this bill was acting retroactively on individuals who've already been sentenced. But, what's being proposed here is that this will apply moving forward. And so if anyone who is involved in a proceeding will know that there is a possibility for short-term transitional leave, assuming that the individual has acted appropriately, and the concerns about the safety of the victims, have been taken into consideration, and all of those things, right? So how exactly there, given that this will be part of the new system, how is that a fraud?
Chair Brzezinski, thank you for that question. Senator Dimbrough, thank you. When they come into the courtroom, and I walk into the courtroom with hundreds of victims over time, I have, they're listening very closely to the words of how long is this person going to be going to prison. And that's why I made the point of a specific number is declared in the courtroom. But a specific number is not declared saying, oh, you can get a 20% reduction for earned time. In addition, you can get another 20% on top of that for alternative incarceration programs. And on top of that, you can get another 180 days reduction for transitional leave. That is not declared. And so that's what I'm referring to is we declare some things with those important numbers because that's what folks are looking at. But we don't declare the numbers that can be reduced from that sentence. That's what I'm referring to.
Doug, I'm sorry. I just have to come in on this. I guess it just seems to me, in all due respect, maybe either yourself, your ADAs, or others around the state aren't doing maybe their full job in preparing and talking to the victims as to how the system works. My understanding, and I haven't been in circuit court for a number of years, but my understanding is that the court still makes a determination as to whether someone's going to be open for alternative sentencing, alternative sanctions. And so I'm trying to figure out why, if it's not happening, a ADA would not be, or a DA, would not be laying this out as to, here's the situation, this is how it works. We are a system that is balanced with retribution to some point, but also accountability and restorative justice. And if someone is doing what they're supposed to be doing and they follow the rules and they are going forward in a positive way, they can seek or receive, reductions in the sentence so long as they are doing part of their part in making, reformation to the system. So it seems to me that's kind of where we're at, and I'm trying to figure out why the terminology, camouflaging, it just, you know, just seems to be a pretty volatile word to be using to describe our system.
Let me answer your question, Chair Przanski, with 2 points. The first point is not every victim, though we try to notify every victim of sentencings and to meet with them ahead of time, but not every victim actually does meet with us beforehand. And so they don't get the explanation. But with the victims that we do meet with, we do give explanations of these things. And so what I can say is that having sat with hundreds of victims, when I explain to them that you're going to hear a number in court that declares 50 months prison, but it really doesn't mean that because potentially it could be 25 months prison, sometimes more. The eyebrows raise, and I have to deal with very upset people who just can't understand why the system would allow for such huge reductions. I think folks understand some reductions, just not these huge reductions that we're dealing with. And so that's how I'd answer that.
Thank you, Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, I just want to comment real briefly. I'm kind of confused because, my limited experience as a police officer, things that I've done, okay, I've seen judges hand out, and in corrections, judges hand out life sentences. Doesn't mean that a person is going to do life. I mean, and when I was in corrections, I've seen people that were handed out a life sentence. They did 7 years, right, and then they were released. And then you look at other people that go up for probation. So that's getting out earlier than the maximum number of years. So I'm trying to figure out how is this the difference here in what we're talking about now. You know, if someone was given 30 months and they do 24 months and then they're released on probation compared to what we're doing now. So I'm just trying to figure out what is the difference. Can you help me out, Chair?
Yeah, the difference is just how we calculate it, and some individuals think that there should be a maximum reduction that someone should be able to receive versus what others think that should be the difference. This is a different policy and philosophy. So I'd like to continue the conversation, but the reality is we have about 16 minutes or so when I've got one more person. Kevin? You have a presentation?
I have a very brief presentation. I assure you it will be very brief, Chair Przanski. For the record,
I just took it that Doug said he was here for ODA, so I just thought you were here.
I wanted to just put in visual terms what District Attorney Martini was talking about, and I assure you I've got 4 slides. They'll be very quick. And again, I think for me it makes a difference to see what these sentence reductions look like. And there are many sentence reductions, and as Mr. Martini said, they aren't reduced concurrently. They're reduced one on top of another on top of another. So this just gives you a sense of, in post-ballot measure 57 world, the one reduction that all generally folks are entitled to is a 20% earned time reduction. With short-term transitional leave as passed in 3194, you'll see there's just a modest change in the amount of reduction time that most of these offenders were eligible for. Under the terms of this bill, you'll see a substantial shift. Those folks at the lower end of the dial that are getting 18, 22, and 24-month sentences now aren't even needing to serve but barely half of their sentence. What's not included in these numbers are the 20% reduction that they're also eligible for if they participate in an alternative incarceration program. Obviously, that's a rigorous program that they need to complete. All the rest of these are largely just, again, options that they have available if they their sentences are reduced. The last one, in a number of counties, 3 at this point, have also instituted work release programs. Those work release programs, in some counties, are as much as a 6-month work release program. When you factor that in, you can see the length of time actually served, again, if you're lucky enough to be in one of those handful of counties, admittedly. So this is really the slide I think most people should focus on. But you really have an opportunity to have some significant sentence reductions here. And I think that's what underscores Mr. Martini's testimony that around truth in sentencing, and I think it's really a core principle that your district attorneys have endeavored to adhere to over the course of any policy discussions that happen around sentencing. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Lithicum.
Just quick, which counties are you referring to in this slide?
The work release counties are Marion County, Lane County, and Jackson County. Those are the three counties that have work release programs. There are a very small number of participants in those programs. Offline, I'm happy to talk to you. I will tell you, as I said, this slide is much more indicative of the general sentencing policy for the state.
All right, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and ask Jeremiah to come up so we can conclude this. I have two other bills after this.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the assistant director with the Department of Corrections, and I have overseen the short-term transitional leave program since its expansion in 2013. You've heard a lot of what my testimony was going to be today, so I just want to highlight a couple of very quick points. First of all, the program has been highly successful as a 90-day program. Kelly Officer's presentation was referring to more than 4,000 inmates who have gone out since December of 2013 on either the 30 or 90-day program. And the return for new criminal activity included both arrests and new convictions. And so only about 50% of those returned on new criminal activity have actually been convicted of the crime. We do take them back if their parole officer has alleged new criminal activity, but it does not mean that they were all convicted. So it's less than a 1% new conviction rate during the period of time in the program. And this is due to the collaboration with the counties. DOC's criteria that you saw in her presentation, along with the county screening, has led to a very successful program. I am testifying neutral, as there are a few other components I just want you to consider as you consider expanding the program to 180 days. Doubling the length of time will not result in twice as many inmates going out into the program. Counties have limited transitional housing options available to them. Already this week, Coos County, for instance, has informed us they can take no more transitional housing inmates out into the program. Counties denied 159 trans leavers last year due to a lack of housing. And so expanding the program is going to be met with some very limited capacity within the counties, especially as we consider right now that community corrections funding is slated for a $13 million reduction, and justice reinvestment is currently slated at an $8 million reduction. And so if all things were to pass the way they're currently looking, we would be faced with a larger program with less resource to serve this higher-risk population. I would also like to just point out, and Senator Steiner Hayward and I have discussed this repeatedly, but unfortunately to no good solution, that they are still, these individuals are in inmate status. That makes them ineligible for Medicaid, Social Security benefits. And so while we may reduce some of the costs of the Department of Corrections, there are other systemic costs that are increased when we're unable to provide some of the same services that we're able to for those who are not under an inmate moniker, if you will. And so I just want to provide that to you as for context as you consider whether or not an expansion meets the goals of what the committee hopes that an expansion of the program would meet. I know there are a number of other questions and issues, and I'm happy to answer any other questions about the program you may have.
Right, Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Jeremiah. So one of the core questions here is what could be the impact on the decision to open another women's prison or another wing? Could this have a positive impact in, you know, as we're weighing the different effects, is there a potential for this to be to contribute to a decision one way or the other?
Chair Przanski and Senator Dimbrough, the Criminal Justice Commission has done a variety of forecast studies, whether you increase it to 120, 150, 180 days. 180 days does stave off the need for an additional prison for a number of years. I don't remember the exact number, but it does push it out further into the future than where it's currently slated to be. So it does have a positive impact on not needing to build or open another women's facility in the immediate future.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
And can I help, Mary?
Chair, may I make some comments on the record regarding this bill?
Very shortly, because I have another committee, another bill I'd like to get done, because I got seven people to testify.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Mary Sell here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I did want to put on the record that we are in support of the current bill in front of you regarding short-term trans leave. Two points that I wanted to make. One, when you walk into court with a defendant and that person is being sentenced on the record, in my experience, the judge does put on the record whether or not that person is going to be eligible for earned time, good time. That's usually something that is discussed between defense counsel and the prosecution. Secondly, regarding alternative incarceration programs, also known as AIP, the court has to make findings to put to make findings that that person's eligible for those programs. And so that's also going to be put on the record. And so all this information is in open court. Mostly people probably don't know how to interpret it, but defense attorneys are tasked with explaining that to the defendants. My understanding is that the prosecution would be tasked with explaining that to the other people who have vested interests when they walk into court. We do believe that this is a good policy, and we just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Mary, thank you very much. All right, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill, let's see, 935. But before I do, I'm going to make one other statement. When we see the stuff that comes up on OLIS regarding that signatures and the agreement, please recognize that this is a bicameral process. The only people that signed on that was the House. The two Senate members, including myself and Senator Winters, were not part of those conversations. That was camouflaged. That was something that was, in fact, done in the cloak of darkness without the Senate being part of it. With that, we're going to close the public hearing. All right, we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing for today. Well, not hopefully our last one, but our next one, which will be Senate Bill 895. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 895 modifies eligibility for the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. The bill includes defendants who are pregnant or have legal custody of a minor child at the time of sentencing. The bill also eliminates a list of current and previous convictions that serve as disqualifiers. Finally, the bill directs the Department of Corrections to establish a process for selecting counties to participate in the program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I have a panel that wants to come up, Steve Berger, Sheila Clark, and Aaron Gladstone. And our time is limited, so if you could summarize, if you have written testimony, that would be wonderful.
Chair Przanski, Co-Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee, my name is Steve Berger, and I'm president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. Thank you for the opportunity to present. During the 2015 regular session, the Oregon Legislature enacted House Bill 3503, which created the 10-year pilot FSAP project to divert qualified offenders who had custody of a minor child at the time of the offense from prison to probation. Based on a successful program in Washington State that reduces recidivism and creates better outcomes for kids, the initiative was designed to provide parents an opportunity to achieve accountability through intensive supervision and services in the community while strengthening bonds with their children and increasing family stability. Our pilot project in Oregon has shown promise. The original pilot limited participation to five specific counties: Deschutes, Jackson, Multnomah, Marion, and Washington County. Senate Bill 895 provides the Oregon Department of Corrections the ability to broaden the participation. This bill also expands FSAP eligibility by removing restrictions pilot FSAP programs found limiting. Such limitations, such as prior convictions for felony DUI, person crimes, and pregnant females. The five participating counties have found this program to be an important alternative for qualified offenders and key in providing important resources to help keep families together. Our association looks forward to working together with the Department of Corrections in developing a process for selecting counties to participate in the expanded pilot program. Next, You will hear from the Washington County FSAP supervisor and probation officer who are providing direct services. It's been their hard work and dedication that has put the legislature's FSAP program in action. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Prozanski, co-chair Senator Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name is Sheila Clark. I am the supervisor of Washington County Community Corrections FSAP program. In January of 2016, our office began the process of building the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, otherwise known as FSAP. The work in building such a program could not have been accomplished without the buy-in and effort of our community partners, which include Washington County Circuit Court, District Attorney's Office, Public Defenders, DHS, CODA Treatment, House of Hope, Bridges to Change, and many more. Today, FSAP is a thriving program that focuses on the most important relationships in life, the parent-child relationship. Since inception, we have worked with 30 parents benefiting 63 children. If FSAP had not been an option at the time of sentencing, these 63 children would no doubt be further embedded in the DHS system, and their parents would be in prison. Childhood experiences have a tremendous impact on future violence, victimization, perpetration, and lifelong health and opportunity. Adverse childhood experiences, such as parental incarceration, are an important public health issue. FSAP participants and their children have high ACE scores. Risk factors captured in the ACE assessment include drug abuse, physical, mental, and sexual abuse, and parental incarceration. Each of these risk factors critically impact our community and especially our children. Success in the community for parents involved in the criminal justice system involves ensuring adequate resources. Factors that are inherent to success include housing, education, employment skills, substance abuse treatment, parenting classes, positive role modeling, and a family-focused approach. When parents are incarcerated, the consequences reverberate to the next generation. In my 24 years as a probation and parole officer, I have experienced multiple generations come through my door. As you may expect, this is difficult to see and experience. I have found myself asking, what could I have done differently to change the outcome? Prior to FSAP, parents did not have family-oriented wraparound services to help them integrate back into the community as a parent. There were standalone programs that dealt with components, but they did not focus on the family unit as a whole. Community Corrections now has an evidence-based strategy and resources to provide a foundation for positive family dynamics, which not only treat the parent, but benefit the children and reduce the overall negative impact on our community. I support the broadening of the eligibility requirements and increased funding of Senate Bill 895, which would allow more families to access the resources needed and make lifelong changes. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Senate Judiciary Chairman Floyd Prozanski, Co-Chair Senator Kim Thatcher, and members of Oregon Legislative Assembly's Senate Committee on Judiciary. My name is Erin Gladstone, and I am the Family Sentencing Alternative Program Probation Officer with Washington County Community Corrections. I am providing written testimony on behalf of Washington County Community Corrections. Within the first year of the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, FSAP, Washington County has served 26 parents and 54 children. We had one revocation within that first year and have had one graduate of the program. DHS Child Welfare has returned custody to four of our parents, which accounts for eight children being removed from the foster care system. Additionally, there are three parents successfully working a return home plan with DHS Child Welfare. I would like to share a story of one of our FSAP parents named Amy. When Amy initially came into FSAP, she was on her last chance with the court, was somewhat resistant to the additional program requirements within FSAP. Within the first month in the program, Amy received a call from Child Welfare that her son had been physically assaulted by the father in the home of his current guardian. She immediately reached out and received support from the FSAP team, which resulted in her moving into the FSAP house with her son. This allowed what could have been a crisis situation to instead be an opportunity for her to shine under pressure. Amy was supported by the FSAP team through the Child Welfare Court assessment process and was able to retain physical custody of her son. Presently, Amy has completed an intensive outpatient treatment program, is actively involved in the recovery community, has been employed steadily for 9 months, and is completely self-sufficient. Amy is our first graduate and recently had the guardianship that was in place through DHS Child Welfare dissolved. During her last DHS hearing, the judge suggested Amy become a parent mentor due to the unique experience and perspective she has to share with other child welfare involved parents, and also asked Amy if he could attend her FSAP graduation ceremony. The success of FSAP in Washington County is due in large part to the resources that have been made available as a result of the funding stream and the cap caseload, which allows for a more intensive supervision model. The participants initially receive weekly office visits and home visits, as well as case planning meetings monthly with the team that includes a mentor, CADC, myself, and also a DHS liaison is involved in weekly meetings. The children that are in DHS child welfare custody are able to transition home to their parents in an FSAP-funded, stable, clean, and sober house and maintain the same school to decrease the amount of trauma sustained during this time. The cap caseload also gives me additional time to attend those weekly staffings and the freedom to be present at DHS court hearings and any other support type appointments for clients. I've had the opportunity to see a change in the children I visit weekly in the FSAP house. Initially, the children were afraid when I arrived as a law enforcement figure, but now they follow me around the house to get stickers and tell me about exciting experiences they have learned or done that week. It has been a growing experience for all of us. The broadening of the eligibility criteria would allow for increased participation, which would likely result in a decrease in the prison population and the number of children entering the foster care system. Thank you for your consideration.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is Trues Neal, Jeremiah Stromberg, and Tim Callahan. Again, if you've got testimony that you've already posted, you do not need to read it in the record. It's already part of the record. If you could summarize, that would be greatly appreciated.
Chair Brzezinski, Co-Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Trues Neal, Deputy Director, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm not going to read my testimony. I just wanted to say, having been in this business for more than 30 years, one of the heartbreaking things for a probation and parole officer is to see that child of someone who's been in the system or has gone to prison come before you and being put on probation or parole. I think this bill, this program is pointing at addressing that issue. Our jobs typically is to address the individual offender. This program addresses a family system that we think is very important in addressing. As you probably know, juveniles are children are, whose parents are in prison or in the system and who end up in foster care are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. This also helps address that issue by focusing on parenting. One of the components that Multnomah County's program has that's similar to Washington County is that parent mentoring and parent training. This is something that a lot of our clients wouldn't get if they weren't in a program like this. So I think this not only averts folks from going to prison and addressing their problems locally, it also addresses the needs of the family. So we in Multnomah County would ask your support for it.
Thank you. Jeremiah?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections, and I oversee this program as well since its inception during the last session. You've heard a lot of the great early successes we've seen of the program. We are going to be working with the CJC to continue to study the long-term outcomes, similar to what you saw for the short-term trans-leave population. 75 participants in this first year, 139 children diverted from foster care. Those are successful numbers, but those are small numbers given the price tag for this program. And so with the passage of this bill, it will allow more participants to be able to take advantage of this program when appropriate. It also allows DOC, in a very similar capacity as we do with other funding streams, to be able to work with counties that may need these resources most and benefit from being a part of the pilot program. And so I would respectfully ask and recommend that you pass this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Tim Callahan, Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The district attorneys support the Family Sentencing Alternative Program. We see the benefits of a front-end program of identifying qualified folks, and we also see the benefits of expanding the eligibility requirements. This was a consensus product. We agreed with it, and it should move.
Yeah, thank you. Questions? I just make the comment, Truls, thank you very much for your testimony. I can only reflect on my days going into court, seeing a person and then having their kids show up, you know, 10, 15 years later, and as the system just continues to, let's say, cycle those families in, and whatever we can do to break it is a great way to do it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, the last person I have for this bill is Ross Caldwell. And Ross, do you have a presentation?
I do.
Excellent.
I can be very brief. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Ross Caldwell from the Criminal Justice Commission. The Criminal Justice Commission staffs the Public Safety Task Force, and the task force heard a lot of testimony about what's working with the Family Sentencing Alternative Program and what is kind of a roadblock keeping it from working as effectively as it could. They made recommendations which are encompassed in this bill, and we support those recommendations. We think this is a good program that gives counties another alternative to prison for parents of children that are looking at prison sentences, and I think these will help them move forward and maximize its capacity to help people. Any questions?
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 895? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. Mike, we're not going to be able to do seven. How much time do you need?
30 seconds.
All right. We'll open a public hearing on the 30 seconds for Senate Bill 713.
Chair Przanski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Senate Bill 713 is it's actually the Dash 1 Amendment. This is a gut and stuff, and all it is doing is asking you to codify essentially the rules that our commission does. Pursuant to ORS 137-667, when our commission, whenever you all pass laws that ask the Criminal Justice Commission to rank a bill in our rules, we then have to bring that back to you for adoption of those amendments. So that's what this bill does. I submitted to council the materials that will explain to you what the different OARs are and do.
All right. Any questions for Mike? Michael, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on 713. And what we're going to do is we'll put a work session together after this today. Colleagues, thank you very much for staying and hearing all the testimony. We're adjourned for today. We'll be back tomorrow at 8 a.m. We'll be back tomorrow at 8 a.m. for today.